Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this episode of Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, PPTS, the progressive radio show that asks the question, what are you going to do about it? Our show addresses the activists, activities, and activism across the United States from the progressive movement. Much more than a party or even a movement, PPTS is a show about action, what we believe the true purpose of a progressive to be. If you have a cause, a candidate, an issue, or a problem you feel needs to be heard by several thousand potential allies, this is the place for you. If you have a disagreement with something you see or feel or think about life where you live, this is the show for you. In fact, you're welcome to call in to our live show at area code 347-324-5825. Become a part of our live broadcast. You can ask your questions or make your comment. We'll respond after you hang up. Coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the mighty Duck River, I am the Tennessee Progressive. Welcome to today's show. Hello and welcome to Progressive Politics Tennessee Style on Coffee Party Radio USA, simulcast with the American Broadcast System Media and Westwood One Media, as well as netrootsradio.com. I am the Tennessee Progressive, and I'm coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia, Tennessee, on this Sunday, November 17th, 2013. We welcome our guest and our co-host, Progressive Patty, to the show. And we look forward to visiting with you in our lively chat room. You can call us if you'd like to talk to us about today's subject at area code 646-929-2495. Again, that's area code 646-929-2495. On today's show, we continue the series, War on the Poor, with our look at the Battle of the Hunger Cliff. And today's show, we'll be talking about a particular portion of the battle for hunger. And I gave you a link that you could pop open
to look at for today's show? You can just have that up there because we're going to talk about it a bit. And to do a quick review, we talked about the battle on the poor, and I chose to use that as the focus feature for all the battles we're going to talk about. The war on the poor, that includes the hunger cliff, war on women, war on education, war on employment, war on voters, war on the poor, the black, the elderly, the handicapped, college students. All these part of the battle that we're generally referring to as the war on the poor. That includes women, health issues, lots of different battles that are going on right now within the confines of the political spectrum. And there are many different sides to many different issues. I chose to begin with the battle over hunger because it's a great jumping off point into other areas of the battle that we're talking about and the greater war at large. I understand that skirmishes lead to battles, lead to wars. And when we began, I said that it was my job as the field general to understand all the battles that are going on all parts of the battlefield and to bring those to you as they made sense. The first battle that we chose to deal with came because of an article that was written on my political blog site, The Daily Coast, by a writer there by the name of W.L. Browning, who wrote a suspiciously wonderful article about the battle on hunger. And come to find out, William Browning is battling that every single day. He sits on the board of directors for Hunger Free Colorado and brought a wealth of information to last week's show. And I'm trying to get that article up so I can link it into the chat room. If you're listening to the show, you should be in the chat room because that's where all the links are going to happen. We want to give you the links that you need in order to be able to follow the thinking that's going on here and add your own. You know, we say if you're going to come, you know, show up prepared. I'll get that link up for you and put it in the chat room shortly. And I've reached out to some other folks, one of whom is affiliated with, William Browning. He's the director of the board, and he suggested I contact his boss, who is the executive director of Hunger Free Colorado. And we're working to set up a time when we can meet with her on air and have an ongoing interview and conversation about the reality, who is actually doing this battle. We want to put faces, names together as we did last week with a friend from North Carolina A&T in Greensboro, who is a young man who has activated his college campus to fight several things, but among which is dealing with registration to vote and helping people who are over the hunger cliff. And Mr. Browning's article was called Crushing the Poor, Cursing Our Future. And I'm going to put that into our chat room right now as a link that you can use. I hope. Yes. And this article is actually what possessed me to begin our conversation with the war on hunger. Of the eight areas that we wanted to talk about, wanted to talk about the war on hunger first because of the information that came out of this article written by William Browning. It's an amazing article that speaks very carefully to his opinion about what's happening with the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which was the focus of our attention and will be for the war on the poor as far as the Battle of the Hunger Cliff. Another quick review, we decided that the Hunger Cliff was defined as a space in existence where those who were one paycheck away or less from realizing food insecurity were lined up. We noticed that 2007 showed that there were 20 million American citizens lined up that were receiving Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, or what were called food stamps. And today there are 47 million American families or individuals lined up on that hunger cliff. Now, on November 1st, there was an expiration of an extension stimulus to the SNAP program that expired, which cut approximately $5 billion from the SNAP program. At the same time, it decimated other programs as well. Women, Infants, and Children program blazed a good part away from Head Start. Just various and sundry programs that were negatively affected by this, and we explained that the reason that happened was because of the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill is a budgeting document that originates in the United States Senate, and we knew that the expiration of the supplemental surplus from the beginning of the American meltdown that was instituted by George W. Bush, president at the time, to help people deal with the difficult situation that the American meltdown had created. It was meant to be temporary, and had the Farm Bill been renewed, it is possible that that extension would have happened for those benefits as well. However, there was a significant threat from the Republican Party that said their intent was not to cut the SNAP program, but to eliminate funding for it. Rather than allow that to happen, Senator Reid did not allow the Farm Bill to come out for a vote. As a result, that $5 billion stimulus expired for these folks, but it was viewed as being a better option than, as many Republicans, including Representative Ryan of Wisconsin, said, we don't need the program. Another representative said, we're depriving people from the blessings of hard work. The same man who quoted the Bible and said, "If they will not eat, let him not. If they will not work, let him not eat." Ideological issues are one thing; realizing the hunger of America is another. And there was no ability at that time to realistically encounter both sides of that conversation at the same time, because the Republicans were not going to do anything except remove themselves from, and the American people from, the SNAP program from takers. And the Democrats were protecting the rights of those who could not help themselves, the least among us, to at least have some sense of assistance when it came to the hunger cliff. Those are some of the folks, as we discussed last week, who are pushing us over the cliff. And the why is because they believe ideologically that it is not in America's best interest to have a social safety net or programs which are meant to assist those who are least among us. This is something that they believed since well before, but certainly in and after 1935 with the creation of Social Security and later programs such as Medicare and Medicaid and what was known as the Great Society, some referred to as the welfare state. So on today's show, we asked the question, how do we track those who are pushing us over the hunger cliff? And there are many ways that you can do that, but you can guarantee that there are certain activities that are strongly involved, and you can begin with the Republican Party itself. If you look at the Republican Party platform for the 2012 presidential election, you will see how they feel about, quote, entitlement programs and the social safety net. Now, some of that stuff is freely available online. And the Republican platform can be seen at the Republican RNC site, too. And you can look up for yourself how the Republicans stated to the world they intended to govern when it came to entitlement programs and assistance to the needy. You can find out about it from some of the supporters that are donating to causes which directly affect lobbying against the SNAP program. And we're going to talk a lot about that today because it was suggested to us by an intended host last week who couldn't come because they were breaking so many important stories last week. Rebecca Wilsey and I have been communicating this week, and she led me up to one of the reports that they released. It was called Something Stinks in Our State Houses, and it's called stinktanks.org. In the information for today's show, I included a link to that site. And it will allow you to actually look at your state. There are some organizations that flow from other organizations at the national level down into the states. And you can actually see who is affecting, among other things, nutritional support and the battle on hunger in your state. And we encourage you to do that. The idea is they're invisible. No, they're not. They're not invisible. And that's not only the new dictum, but it's the new reality. Some of these folks are so convinced that they cannot be stopped that they're now publicly advertising their cause, which is at least enlightening because at least now we know who it is. We're confirming that we've always known who we're dealing with. And if you go to Rebecca Wilsey's organization's site, you can get there by going here. I'll put it in the chat room. And you can see where a lot of these things are coming together in the reports that they have. And you'll find that there is a very strong connection in all of these things politically. The connection is made legislatively at both the state and federal levels through the American Legislative Exchange Council. And when you look at stinktanks.org, you will see that there is a chart on PR Watch that allows you to see exactly how that happens. Now, there is a midwinter meeting scheduled for ALEC in December where they're going to create or pass out model legislation to get states off of Medicaid, Medicare exchanges, Medicaid exchanges, chipping away at the 17th Amendment, and other things, including the reduction and elimination of the SNAP program. And their basic argument is that it is not government's business to be helping people eat. They feel that that's overreach. You have to understand that the originators of ALEC are extreme libertarians who believe that no government is best. Well, not quite, but they want you to understand that having a government is okay so long as it is the kind of government that they prefer. There is another tie-in to this, which comes from the Dominionist movement, which has such eager associates as Governor Rick Perry, Senator Rafael Ted Calgary Cruz, and others. Michelle Bachmann comes to mind. Who believe that the purpose of government is to be a corporatist plutocratic theocracy. Now, you've got to understand, yes, there are three parts to that, but they all three deal specifically with the battle on hunger. In the elimination of what they call the entitlement programs, which, you know, we need to understand clearly are not entitlements because they are prepaid, self-funded insurance programs. And we also deal with Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution when it talks about the government's responsibility to provide for the general welfare of its citizens. It is not only an ideal. It is a task that is given to the United States government. That is one of the things that we as citizens have always expected our government to do, to help those who could not help themselves. And it sounds like it's a really good idea for people to have to work for their own food or starve. There are not a lot of people who are living in this country today, but there are some who can tell you what it was like before 1935 for the poor and for senior citizens in this country. And it was not pretty. In fact, the reality was that those folks were homeless. They were on the streets. They were begging. They created Hoovervilles, became hobos. And they did some things that were not very healthy as far as getting themselves something to eat. The question is, does it matter today? I submit that it does. And I submit that it does because of the numbers that are involved. For instance, the 47 million Americans that are involved in the SNAP program now that are seeing their benefits cut on a regular basis. Veterans who are involved with single family members or as single parents of small children who are finding their SNAP benefits reduced even further. And these are the very same folks that those on the other side of the aisle, the political aisle, the Republican, conservative, ultra-conservative, and Tea Party members, want to drop support for. When 87% of those who are on the SNAP program are not those who are in the demographic for being in the workforce, there's an issue here. Do we want our 87-year-old grandmothers going out to work at Walmart? Or do we want to repeal the child labor laws so that children under 13 can work 40 hours? These are old arguments. Old, old arguments. There are arguments against child labor laws being repealed that go back to 1801. There are arguments against providing a minimum wage because it would destroy business. There are arguments in terms of being able to help those who need help. One of the arguments that the conservatives or the Republicans have come up with, well, okay, so we give them help. How long? Must they be on this situation for a lifetime? Well, I don't know. I know since 2007, 27 million more Americans have gone on to the SNAP program as a direct result of the American meltdown, which was ushered in for us by President George W. Bush. And I know that our economy has suffered to the point that it is fragile, it is stable, but any major attempts to deal with the economy certainly at this point could spin it out of control. When the Republicans shut down the government and threatened to default on the good faith and credit of the United States, had that been accomplished, we would be in a spin-down mode now that would see us in a black hole of economic collapse worldwide. This president decided that he was not going to allow the American people to be held hostage for an ideological stand. When it came time for the debt ceiling limit increase, they said, well, we'll sign that bill so long as you defund Obamacare. Okay, this is not a negotiating instrument. This is an act of governance. And the president said, we will not be held hostage to an ideological point. You will raise the debt limit so that Congress can pay for the bills it has authorized in previous Congresses, or the government will shut down. And if the government shut down, it's on your head. So bring forth a clean CR, and then we can negotiate about everything. Well, let's go to conference. Well, we tried to go to conference 20 times prior to this event. Every single time, the Republicans refused to go to conference. We saw a lot about Eric Cantor and the other seven white men sitting at a table waiting for the Democrats to show up. Well, you know what? We know that feeling because we did it 20 times. We're not doing it anymore. We're not going to hold America hostage to an ideological political policy question. Ain't going to happen. This week, there was another attempt to defund the American Affordable Care Act. While at the same time, we've heard for a couple of weeks about all the horror stories of people going on to the healthcaregov.site, it's interesting that we're not hearing so much about all the sudden victories that are being established this week, because for the last 4 or 5 days, the healthcare.gov site has been working with an average of less than 1% error. We heard a lot about insurance companies, but we haven't talked about collusion and conspiracy charges against insurance companies. You see, when people have to determine whether they're going to pay for their medicine or pay for their food, we're still talking about those that are on the edge of the hunger cliff. And in America today, there are many millions of people who have to make that choice either for themselves or for their families. So what I want you to understand clearly is that these things are interconnected, and that's how we get from one point to the next in this battlefield that I'm trying to describe for you, that I want you to see the interconnectedness of the plan that is, in general, the war on the poor. When you deal with food, and you have to deal with food insecurity, that means that in a 24-hour period, you are not convinced that you will have a meal or a next meal. That lines you up on the hunger cliff. Now, it may be because you're out of a job. It may be that you're a single mom and you're working 3 jobs. Happens a lot. It may be that you're disabled and on a very small Social Security income or a Social Security disability or Social Security supplemental, and you live off a very fixed income each month, and you have much more month than you have money. And you have to decide how you're going to spend those limited resources in various and sundry different areas, electricity. And we talked about LIHEAP last week, where heating fuel is suddenly an issue because the prices have gone up 176%. And the resources are less available this winter than they were last winter. And we talked about it on a day where here, at least, it was 29 degrees overnight. And we talked about it being an issue across the country. And when you're having to fork out that much more money for basic coverage of your necessary needs, which are eat, sleep, and warm, you have less to feed your family with. You have less to feed yourself with. And single moms are missing meals so that their kids can have something to eat. Our teachers are seeing kids coming into schools that are not prepared to learn because they're fatigued. They're worn out from hunger. We talk about obesity versus poverty. And we talk about the relationship and the co-relationship between the types of foods that children who are receiving SNAP benefits are able to eat as opposed to those who are not, who don't have to worry about that. Because we know that there is nothing more expensive than nutritious food in America unless it is nutritious food for diabetics, for instance. If you have a specialty diet and you're eating for one, you've got a very, very expensive diet. And sometimes, most times, people choose to have something to eat rather than to have one meal a day that is more nutritious and have two meals a day where they're hungry. These choices are made by Americans all across our globe every single day. They're impacting our local economies by the billions of dollars. When you take $5 billion out of the SNAP program, you're taking approximately $8 billion in revenue and return out of the economy. Grocery stores who receive payment for these SNAP benefits have to lay off employees, or they have to close early, or they have to order less supplies. Usually what happens is they send their employees to part-time, or they, you know, they lay off or furlough an employee entirely. If they have a part-time employee, that part-time employee may be the one that is let go, whereas a full-time employee then may not have to go to part-time or half-time. Those families do not have that income to put into the economy, and therefore it becomes a more vicious cycle. When you take that kind of money out of a struggling economy, understanding that in the course of the last 5 years, we have reduced the deficit in this country by more than half, which you don't hear a lot about, then you get to look at taking the pressure off the deficit and how to spend the money that taxation brings into the government. Okay, George W. Bush decided he was going to give everybody in America a tax rebate and cut taxes at the same time and start two wars, which he put on America's credit card because he did not put them into the budget and appropriations confluence in the Congress. He said, we'll pay for it later. Welcome to later. And then the fraudsters created criminal acts against the people and the goodwill of this nation in the foreclosure and housing meltdown, which led to the big banks failing, which led to the bailouts, which was the last thing that Bush did before leaving office, underfunding it by about $98 billion they figured it was underfunded by. There was only so big a hand they dare put into the till of the United States Treasury. Meanwhile, at the same time, they're arguing about deficit decrease. They're spending like drunken sailors. Now, it's often been said that Democrats know how to spend money. It's tax and spend, tax and spend, tax and spend. That's an old lie that people still believe. Okay? If you look at the amount of money that was spent in the United States by the government between the years 2000 and 2008, I think you'll see that Democrats don't hold a candle to the ability of Republicans to spend our money. And if it comes to the ability to create money, they're even worse. When we're talking about welfare, generally speaking, what most people think of are such things as the SNAP program. Okay? That $5 billion cut that was the extension to the stimulus package that George Bush provided the SNAP program could have well more than been covered by a reduction by that amount in the farm subsidies that this Congress pays to large agricultural corporations. Wouldn't have been a drop in their bucket. They didn't do that. They didn't touch those subsidies. They just cut SNAP. They refused to allow the bill to come to the table because they didn't want to cut an additional $5 billion. They wanted to cut $40 billion out of the program over the next 10 years. There are those of us on the progressive and democratic side of the aisle who thought that was a bit extreme, that we could not afford to have that many poverty-stricken people out on the street at the same time. And we would not do that to our own citizens. So it becomes a question of, is it the right thing to do? Does that give everybody a fair shot, a fair chance, a fair break? And the answer was no. So we didn't do it. And rather than allow that to even become possible, Senator Reid and the Democrats in the Senate decided they were going to take the $5 billion haircut and save the rest of the SNAP program. A lot of people did not like that. The farm bill still has not cleared the Senate because of the ongoing threat of the Republicans not only to filibuster that bill, but to put amendments on it that would make it unpassable, which is actually what they want. Remember that the Tea Party and the right-wing establishment of the Republican Party, which is currently in its first time forever largest meltdown, imploding in upon itself, wants its farewell to be the utter destruction of American government. Now, I don't say that because they say so. I say that because of the actions they have proceeded to create. And when it comes to the hungry, we have increased the number of people who are not only on the SNAP program, but you have to remember there is a large number, millions upon millions of Americans who don't even fit that profile. They work. So, you know, they could be what's called over-resourced. There are people who receive disability income, depending on the state you live in, where because you receive a Social Security disability income, you're $100 over-resourced or so for food stamps. And as a result of that, you make too much to be on food stamps, but you don't make enough to survive. When you can't survive, it's called subsistence. That's sub-existence. And then you have to figure out, well, okay, I'm not going to eat every day, so how many days will I eat this month? And you try to create a schedule and a grocery list and provide groceries for yourself for the month, and it is the case usually at the end of the month. A lot of those folks are really hungry, so they overshop. They have good meals for a while, then they start skinning back, then they start skinning back some more, then they start skinning back some more. You've got to remember that when the $5 billion haircut happened to the SNAP program, it went into effect November 1st. Well, you have other things going on, okay, like employers like Walmart telling their workers that they have to work on Thanksgiving. I mean, after all, why not? You're not going to be able to eat. I'd like to know what you think about this. I am the Tennessee Progressive, and you can call our show at area code 646-929-2495. The question is, what do you think about this? You call our show or join our lively chat room, and you can talk with our co-host and chat room monitor, Progressive Patty. Let us know what your thoughts or concerns are. We're both in the chat room, and we'll respond to you on air. And, of course, you can call us at 646-929-2495. Dial 1 if you would like to get on the air, and Progressive Patty will set you up, and then we'll talk for a while. I encourage you to do that. And there's so many different arguments that have no basis in reality when it comes to the SNAP program that it's almost difficult, A, to take them seriously, but B, to bring out the truth so that American citizens can make informed decisions about what they're going to do. We have seen that there is virtually no limit to which the Republicans and those who fund them will not go to get what they want, not because it's the right thing to do, but because they have money, and they've been told that money is equal to power, and that power is equal to speech. And when the government started to shut down, one of the things we heard was that Congress members were still going to take their pay, of course, because after all, they have a house and a kid in college to pay for. I'm not exactly sure why it didn't exactly pass their understanding that there are plenty of those under the poverty level, nearly at the poverty level, or just above the poverty level, who could say exactly the same thing. They, too, have a house and kids in college to pay for. They, too, have health care needs that they have to address financially. They need to understand that it's not always possible to offset one cost with another cut. Okay, we hear a lot about we have to balance the budget of the American nation like we balance our checkbooks at home. Well, if you and your balanced checkbook at home can declare war on a country, fund and support an army, or say two, for an untold amount of time, using largely private contractors who get no compete bid contracts, which means that the government decides who it's going to use and nobody else gets a chance to try. Where does that stack up with a small business owner of four or five people who's going to pay for it? Okay? It doesn't make sense. We argue that government programs are enabling or creating fraud. Yet we know, in fact, that at the run-up to the Iraq War, at one point, there was $6 billion in cold, hard cash that went missing within a month. That has never been accounted for. In fact, they were tossing around in Blackwater Security Headquarters what they called bricks, which were stacks, bound stacks of money, and between $100,000 and $1 million stacks. Where'd the money go? We don't know. It's never been accounted for. We haven't audited or reviewed those contracts. What we have done is we have removed ourselves from one war zone for the greater part and are in the process of removing ourselves from another one. Well, what has any of this got to do with the war on hunger? Well, those people that are being removed from the war zones are for the larger part coming home. They're being disconnected from the government. They're being disconnected from their roles. And they're becoming civilians. And interestingly enough, a very large number of them becoming what we call veterans are having to apply for assistance with SNAP. So when somebody came back last September, got reintegrated into the system and started receiving the support they needed when they came home, the first thing they saw was that those benefits got for SNAP. I'm not talking about VA benefits or increased waiting times for first appointments for intake to the Veterans Administration system. I'm not talking about schools that they couldn't afford to go to because all of a sudden they weren't getting the awards of their education grants that they'd been promised. I'm not talking about the housing subsidies that they'd been promised that never showed up because there weren't any houses. I'm not talking about the fact they couldn't find a job because there are no jobs to be had in this country. I'm not talking about any of that. I'm just focusing on their hunger. And then they are reduced, basically, to begging for food. Much like it was in 1930s with our elderly. They're seen as slackers. Go out and find a job. They're seen as takers because they're begging for food. Anyone who is begging for food is hungry. I'm not talking about I missed a meal hungry. I'm talking about I haven't eaten in a couple of days or 3 days or 6 days hungry. We have to understand that hunger has several definitions in this country, and it's one thing to say, if a man will not work, let him not eat, but what happens if there is no work for that man? I hear about all these wonderful jobs that are available for technical areas in the United States, but I can't find anybody that's hiring for less than minimum wage or more than minimum wage. And minimum wage is in this country a subsistence existence. We saw in the elections of November in several states that there was a rather significant increase demanded by the citizens of this country for the minimum wage rate, which basically went from, say, $7.16, $7.50 an hour to $10, and in one case, $15 an hour in the most expensive economy in the country. But it's relative. And what the result is that employers are suddenly cutting back on the hours available to those minimum wage employees because they get subsidized by the government for doing so. A good example is McDonald's, where a lot of these veterans are going to look for work, where a lot of these people who are begging for food are going to look for work. And they may get 12 hours per week because with the increased minimum wage, well, we got to cut your hours because, you know, they passed that minimum wage law. We're going to keep you down. We're going to keep you under the circumstances. Because we're going to increase, or we're certainly going to maintain our profit. We're not going to lose profit. We're going to lower our wealth. You work for us. You have the responsibility to make us rich, but we don't have the responsibility to make sure you can live. That's not our job. That mentality is one of the things that we have to turn around, and I think that we can do that if we will but discuss it. As many as will find that position to be completely acceptable, I guarantee you there are many, many more who in this country will find it objectionable. And we need to understand that if we have one person in this country who is hungry, that person is not free. They're no more free than anyone else who is yoked. Our children cannot go to school and learn because, as I mentioned in a previous show, they go to school and dream of fruit. They are so exhausted from being consistently, chronically hungry that they're simply not in a position to learn. And as a result of that, over the last decade, we've seen the general test scores in American public education go down a significant amount. We've seen increased hospital visits by those who are not insured by a significant amount. We've seen people go onto and come off of or fall off of the unemployment rolls at an increasing amount. And the net result of these and other things is that those who are least among us as a group are growing. As a population segment, it's a very fast-growing population segment. And I said yesterday on these airwaves that the fastest-growing population segment in America today is the population referred to as the hobo. I had a man come to my door while I was speaking those very words. And asked my care worker, who answered the door, if there was any work that I had that he might do for me in order to receive a meal. He didn't want money. He just wanted to know if there was a meal he could have, a sandwich or something. Unfortunately, my care worker had to tell him, no, there isn't, because he has trouble affording his own meals. When I say these things to you, citizen, I'm not talking from an unknown perspective. I'm not talking from an out there y'all perspective. I'm talking from an inside, yeah, I really do get it. I've got the same situation here too. Now, I don't have the same situation a lot of people do, because I have a little bit of a backup system, that if I'm really truly hungry, there are those who will bring me a hamburger. Okay? There's a difference between that and dignified work and a meaningful wage and a respectable retirement. For someone who's worked every day of his life full-time since the age of 13 and a half, it's very difficult for me to understand that I now must exist for a month on much less than I used to make per day. That's part of the shock of falling through the bottom. Those middle-class folks who were suddenly attacked when the meltdown happened were not expecting it, were not prepared for it, had never seen anything like it before, and they fell into an alien universe. And they don't know where to find food. They don't know how to get food. They don't even know how to apply for food stamps or to qualify and register to vote. They don't know all of these things because they're dealing with shelters. And these folks come out of, you know, multi-hundred-thousand-dollar homes with kids in the best schools who all of a sudden are living in cars, who don't talk to their classmates because they don't want them to know that they don't have a permanent address. And their parents can't find work because it's a generally accepted rule that you do not hire people who live in shelters. More generally, it is not generally a rule that you ever hire anybody who does not have a permanent address, even if that is a post office box. So there's an additional rule that says if you have been consistently unemployed for more than 1 year, do not go to the unemployment office and apply for work because you will not be granted interviews, they will not read your resume, and you will not be hired because you are now chronically unemployed. It makes no difference as to what you did do or what you now do. Push down more, press down and shake it to the point that the only direction of movement for 99% of Americans today is downward. Pushed toward the hunger cliff by the pressures asserted by ideological differences. I cannot wake up the moral conscience of the conservative mind, although I could certainly argue with them for a very long time about their morality. I could not knowingly walk past a starving human and do nothing. I don't care if that was an 87-year-old grandmother, a 40-year-old male, or a 4-year-old child. Because of the threats, not the perceived threats, but the real threats to the farm bill, the average amount of dollars given to feed a mouth for a month was reduced $36. That doesn't sound like a whole lot unless, of course, you have $141 or $122 per month to feed that mouth. But see, the national average is $81.43 a month to feed a mouth on the SNAP program. And that doesn't include prepared foods or hot foods. That doesn't include non-food, purely food items. You can get ramen noodles, but you can't get toilet paper. You can get canned soup, but you can't get deodorant. You can get stock meat for making soup on your own, but you can't buy paper clips or anything in the necessities aisle, you know, like, I don't know, sanitary napkins. You've got to understand that the choices that are being made by those people who are living at or below the poverty line in such level that they receive SNAP food benefits, they don't have anything else to add to that budget to create a nutritious security for their family. The thought was that the SNAP program would help assist other income provide nutrition for families. What we have right now, and it is a right now thing, is that we have so many millions of Americans that are broken into the system unintentionally, unwillingly, and involuntarily that the system cannot take them. That's a problem. What are we going to do about it? Well, we have a coffee party that says that if you will come and join us, if you will come and talk to us and let us have reasonable civil discourse, we might find some areas of moderation or accommodation or compromise that would allow us to do something real without giving up our ideals on either side. The question is, what are you willing to give up for what you get? That's a question that both parties struggle with on a daily basis, even as there is a joint commission in the Senate and the House on the budget right now, getting virtually no movement whatsoever. Because, you know, you can't negotiate when your first negotiating position is, I'm not giving anything up. That's not negotiation. That's tyranny. When 47 times you attempt to take away from millions of Americans their first ever opportunity to receive not only real, significant, but also affordable health care so that they too can work to be healthy enough to go to school, to get a job in this country, providing meaningful income. Because of an ideological difference that you've sold to people who don't know any better. It's the same argument that we had in 1930s when they talked about another possibility. When we started talking about Social Security. The reality before us today is that we are imbued with a minority party who is so well-funded that they can spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year on lies. They start with ideological lies. They're takers. No, they're not. When you think to yourself, these are leeches. No, they're not. They're not leeches. I will tell you to this day, I still have not met anyone who, given a choice, would prefer to be on food stamps, who would prefer to be in public housing, who would prefer to be at a free clinic, who would prefer to be living in their car. So these are the people that you're referring to as takers. But what you need to realize is these are single moms. These are veterans. These are the elderly. These are the disabled. These are people who don't qualify into that 1865 age span distance to be able to work. They're not takers. They're the fallen. They're the children of the fallen. Would you pass by a starving child and not feed them if they were on the streets of America? Because what your ideology is telling me is that it's perfectly all right to do that, and then you're going to do it in the name of Jesus. That's when we have real problems. When we talk about the war on hunger, it's not so much a purposeful intent, I believe, by those with an ideological difference like Republicans or conservatives or Tea Partiers concerning the hungry in this country. I believe it's worse than that. I believe they just don't care. I believe they just don't see. These are not generally the people you will see staffing a food pantry or a shelter where you have to line up at 2 o'clock in the morning and stand online in freezing cold until 9 o'clock in the morning and stand a really good chance of not having any food left by the time your turn comes in line. And I'd like to leave you with this thought before we take a short break. And that is, I remember as a kid, yes, I was once a kid, don't look shocked, hearing stories in Russia about people lining up at grocery store doors hours before the store opened for whatever was available on the shelves that day. And within minutes, the shelves would be empty, the stores would close, and all those people would be hungry for another day, or they wouldn't have what they need. So, while there are those who disagree, the question is, can we converse without being disagreeable? Is there some way that we can come to an accommodation of understanding whereby we address the needs of those who are hungry today and work to provide opportunities for them to create meaningful employment, have meaningful wages, so that they're not hungry? That, to me, is an interesting question. And we're going to come back on the other side of this show, and we're going to have some conversations with some folks who maybe disagree or maybe agree. I hope you'll stay tuned because it matters. I didn't say that we're always right, and I didn't say that anybody else is always wrong. What I said was, it's a problem that only we together as a nation can fix. And leaving people hungry on the streets is not a fix. It is to ignore, to walk away from the needs of those that are least among us. I'm not really cool with that, but there are those who are. Listen to a short introduction from a series that we did some time ago. Let's have a civics minute. You're listening to Progressive Politics Tennessee Style. I am the Tennessee Progressive. Thank you for calling. We'll be back with you in a couple of minutes. Thank you.
Is inundated with political news promoting a given ideological stance, one way or the other. Stories, videos, and pictures are posted on social media sites, and news websites and blogs have a very large audience tuning into them for the latest political moves coming from D.C. and in the country. Of course, there is a huge audience that watches the 24/7 news networks to keep up with the politics as well. It is obvious they promote their own political positions. But which one is right or wrong? This is where understanding American civics can help in resolving for yourself the correct answer. There are many the federal and state governments to confuse the public to what is happening. Sometimes that is exactly why it's done, to keep their actions under the public radar. My hope is to point you in the right direction for being your own civics detective so that you can know the truth of what's going on in our government. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA Blog Talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute.
There are many arguments proclaiming the evils of big government, and it always seems to come back to the same arguments made by the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists during the days of our founders, concerning the differences between a strong central government and a weak central government. The Second Continental College adopted the Articles of Confederation on November 15, 1777, and it was in place until 1789. But it was replaced by the Constitution, which advocated for a stronger central government. Why was it replaced? The Articles of Confederation maintained the principle that the national government would not hold more power than the states, that which they saw as sovereign. This satisfied the fears that many of the states had regarding a strong central power, as Britain was before the Declaration of Independence. In fact, there was no executive branch, because they feared giving one man that much power, and it was decided that the Congress would handle all the nation's affairs. However, there were many inherent weaknesses with the Articles of Confederation. The national government did not have the power to tax. Congress did not have the power to force states to obey its laws. Congress could not enforce laws. Each state could issue its own paper money. Any state could put tariffs on trade between other states or countries. There was no system of national courts. Congress could declare war and raise an army, but it could not force the states to give men or money. After the Revolutionary War, the country went into a deep post-war depression. The states were threatening war with each other, and there were armed uprisings and riots across the land. Things eventually got so bad that the country was on the verge of a civil war. This was called the critical period. Because each state was printing their own money, the value depreciated soon after the war, and many returning soldiers were paid in currency they considered to be worthless. There are stories that some soldiers wallpapered their house with the paper currency. On May 25, 1787, the Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia to decide the fate of the Articles of Confederation, and on September 17, 1787, a new constitution was approved, which had the much-needed, stronger central powers. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA Blog Talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
Hello and welcome back to Progressive Politics Tennessee Style. I am the Tennessee Progressive coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia. This is Sunday, November 17th, 2013. I would like to remind you that you can call into our show and give us your comment or question. You can join us in our live chat room. You can listen to a replay of this show as well on Tuesday evening beginning at 9 p.m. Pacific Time, which is midnight Eastern Time, over at netrichradio.com, the NetRich Radio Network. And you can always pull the archives, pull the show and listen to it as an episode from the archives at the Coffee Party USA site. I want to tell you that we are sponsored by the Coffee Party, and this is the Coffee Party USA Radio Network. Today we're talking about hunger, the hunger cliff. And who is restricting our ability to deal with those who are being pushed over the hunger cliff? And we have a caller on the line named Jay who would like to disagree with me, I think. Jay, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Where are you calling from today?
New York.
New York, the city?
Queens.
Oh, Queens, cool. Okay. Hello, Queens.
Yeah, the most diverse county in the world.
I would almost agree with that, although I know there are a lot of folks in Brooklyn that would disagree. But I could understand why you say that.
I think it is, yeah. I think according to the stats, we are. And it looks like we are.
Have you guys pretty much leveled off? I mean, are you kind of stable now after Sandy, or are you still in trouble?
Yeah, most everything is back to normal. I guess next to the water, I'm sure there's still problems, but most of us, everything seems back to normal.
Well, I'm grateful for that. I know it was a terrible time. What would you like to disagree with me about?
Well, you say that conservatives, you think they just don't care.
That's one of the things I said. Yeah, I did say that.
Yeah, and you know, the left considers conservatives and the Tea Party racist. How do you want to work together?
I didn't say that.
Right, but that's what the left claims.
Well, I'm of the left, and I don't claim that, but that's okay. Please go ahead.
Okay, well, even just that we don't care, I mean, you know, I feel like the liberals are the ones that don't want to negotiate, especially when they feel that everything that the other side does is because of racism against the president or greediness or selfishness and that we just don't care. And
okay.
That's not true.
Okay. I would say that as a universal statement, it's not true. I would say as a limited statement, there's plenty of room on both sides for people to consider that reality. I don't limit it. Now, I'm speaking personally for myself now as a progressive Democrat, okay? I don't believe that every Democrat or every progressive believes that no liberal or that no conservative cares. I believe that what we see is such a difference in ideology that the net result is that if the ideology of the conservatives or the Tea Party are followed out, that the victims of that policy being in place are off the radar of a lot of conservative policymakers and most Tea Party policymakers. I would say that I believe that part. When it comes to the citizens who are out in the hinterlands, I don't believe that at all, because I believe the further in distance you get from the Beltway of Washington, D.C., the more you actually lose your political affiliation identity and become more citizen. So what I believe is that if we can discuss these things as citizens, we can then give marching orders to our electeds who are in Washington, regardless of the party, and say, it may seem that we are dealing with takers and we need to decrease the budget, but when we have 776,000 veterans who are suddenly without food for meals in a month because of a $5 billion cut to the SNAP program, that needs to matter to us. That's what I would say. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I think we spend, the federal government and the city and states spend more money than any people in the history of man on poor already. And if something is not working here, I don't know how we all. And plus, we're 17 trillion dollars spending over what the richest country in the world ever, you know, even collects. We're still 16-17 trillion in debt, and we spend so much. Well, why is the poor growing?
When you say that we're 17 or 16 trillion in debt, that's actually not an accurate number, because the deficit has gone down significantly in the last 5 years. We are growing the deficit at the smallest rate we have in over, I think, 100 years, percentage capita, per capita wise. So a lot of the stuff that we have had to deal with as a nation, I don't think it's fair to take away the victories we've been able to achieve as a nation in addressing those things. So I think it's fair for us to talk about real numbers. And
well,
you are absolutely
correct
in the fact that we spend more than many other nations. Like, for instance, how many Chinese are there in China? Does anybody know? Is it 2 billion? Is that a fair number to say?
Almost.
Okay. We spend more than China does in this country to support our citizens overall.
Anyone we spend more than.
We're not measurable. We're not measurably comparable because we have entirely different government systems. Everything in China belongs to the state, and everything that the people of China receive, they receive from the state. And if, you know, we hear, for instance, about these corporation manufacturing plants in China that have 700,000 employees. We don't often hear that last year one of the largest manufacturers in China had to shut down and sent all of those employees to a wage labor camp.
Okay,
we can't send 700,000 people to a wage labor camp. We don't have them.
Well, sir,
you see what I'm saying?
Spend,
go ahead.
Yeah, if you know, you can't say to Michael Jordan, hey, we need to score a few more points, when he scores more than any other player. You know, it's, you know, no one was going to walk up to him and say, hey, we need to score more. I mean, we're spending more than any country in the world, not just China, any country. We spend $6 trillion a year disbursement, city, state, and federal. You know, there's the reason we are against healthcare and government control is because we don't want to give control of the entire healthcare industry to a small group of politicians and bureaucrats, because everyone, no one cares. Conservatives don't care, and liberals don't care. I mean, we care. 2%, 3% of our interest is caring about others, but the human condition is 97% selfish. I mean, there could be a homeless person up to three blocks away from you. You're not going to make sure he sleeps in your house if he doesn't find someone else. You know, we spend $100 on $600 on iPhones while people are hungry, and you know, millionaires, they have huge, they're buying their third car when they can feed a family for a year with that money. They already have three cars, they're going to buy a fourth car. I mean, so,
well,
but
that's very true, but you also have to understand, Jay, is that millionaires don't see this problem. Okay? It's not a problem for the average millionaire, well, it's millionaire, billionaire. Let's go to billionaires because that makes it a more reasonable percentage, I guess, for the topic of conversation. When you're on your third Bentley, you don't see poverty because you don't, you're not in an environment where poverty exists. That is simply a reality of the wealthy. They insulate themselves away from those realities for a very specific purpose. They don't want to have to see them.
But even the average person spends excessively. We all have toys and gadgets, and that when we don't help, and there's people hungry that night.
But we also have a history of being an industrialized nation that is a consumer nation. We make things so that we can buy them, which is kind of silly, but yes,
right.
We do.
But the point is that people are going to look out for themselves first, always, and then they'll look for others when it makes them for whatever purpose they want. But in general, they think of themselves. And these politicians and bureaucrats, they're taking over healthcare for their own power, control, and money. It's obviously not to make it more affordable. Prices are going up. People are getting canceled. Doctors are saying they're not going to work for Medicare prices when they're going to be forced to. And all because we want to insure 30 million uninsured. CBO says there's going to be 30 million uninsured when it's over, when Obamacare is implemented. But they want to take control. And then when people like me, conservatives, will say, we don't let there be freedom. Let healthcare advance like the iPhone. you know that in a year or two there's going to be a better phone. You know it's going to be better and more powerful and 10 times more amazing. We know that because it's a profit-based market, free market system.
But
in
we also
know
we
don't
it's
know.
Going to be more expensive, right?
No.
The iPhone
cheaper.
That you buy tomorrow is not going to be cheaper than the iPhone you buy today.
No, I'm sorry. The iPhone that we bought 2 years ago, you can buy now for $30. The one that they made 3 years ago.
Yeah, but not the day it breaks. Not the day it breaks. And the day it comes out on the market is the most expensive it'll ever be, right?
Yeah, and then it goes down from there. Every day it goes down. Every week
now,
there's new computers.
Let me ask you a question. When you talk about people getting canceled, do you think that the Obama administration did that?
Absolutely. It's the regulations requiring them to comply with the Affordable Care Act requirements for every plan. And when
okay.
they know that not these plans are not standard, they're substandard, they know about it, but they're going to make them standard, requiring them to be changed or canceled.
Okay. If you were to go to buy an iPhone and you paid, let's say they normally sold for $600, okay, and you buy one and it's on sale for $300, and you think I've got a hell of a deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you open it up, and there's no guts. And what you have bought for $300 is an iPhone case that looks like an iPhone, carries like an iPhone, but it doesn't work like an iPhone. What would you say about that? Would you say,
well,
my tough luck, I got screwed?
Well, if it's a fraud, then there's laws against fraud. And no, and then I tell my friends, and quickly, that company never sells again within a few months because there's other places where you know you're going to get what you pay for. And we have a choice of competitors, of suppliers, and we choose the supplier that does it the best. And the second one, even if one does it the best, the second someone else does it better, we go to the better one. And we always get the best of our choice, and we don't get stuck forced with it. Like in insurance, which is state-controlled by politicians, public schools, which are force you to have no choice, and you're stuck to go there, and then they're not so good. But that's what you can expect. We need freedom and not government control over industries. They destroy it, and they use it for their own profit. They have billions – they have checkbooks where they write checks where the accounts have billions in them. I mean, imagine you're sitting with a checkbook like that. You think they're not – you think they don't know where the money is going? You think they're giving contracts for $1 billion here and there, and they're like, oh, my friend just opened up a construction company, and I'm going to give it to him. And my friends in Canada have a website that we always give them $300 million for a website that doesn't work, and then we pay them to fix it. This is what's going on. That's why
that's
we need
some of what's going on. That is absolutely some of what's going on. One of the things that I would encourage you to consider is the fact that when these healthcare insurers came out and started canceling accounts because they knew that they had sold fraudulent junk insurance, well, junk insurance, it says if you get run over by a steamroller, we'll bring you a Band-Aid if it happens on Tuesday, okay? And you pay $54 a month for that. It is fraudulent product. They know it. They've been able to sell it under the radar for years. All of a sudden, the government says to them, I don't know where you ever got the notion that this would be considered to be legitimate insurance, but it's not. And if you want to continue selling insurance under this policy line, you have to make certain agreements that you will cover certain things that most people certainly need from their insurance. We're not talking about catastrophic health care here. We're talking about wellness checks, diabetic checks, those sorts of things that generally – you know, so I think of it as the kind of thing you could get at a health department, okay? And the insurance companies have said, oh, no, 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 that will cost us too much money. What we'll do is we'll cancel those policies as a class. The government says if you do that, you are admitting to have committed fraud. All of a sudden, the insurance companies are in a pickle. Because they've got gazillions of dollars in premium dollars that they have collected from these junk policies off of people that they can't do anything with. They either have to give back or they have to generate policies. This happened. This basically is insurance companies paying back the government from that benefit reimbursement the insurers had to make to people for the last 2 years. And what they're saying is the spread of profit is not sufficient for us as a business to cover these policies, which we've sold to you for years. Another example, if I may. In the state of Texas, Governor Perry said, we're not going to have a Medicaid expansion. We're not going to participate in the marketplace. We're going to have our own self-funded insurance for those members of our state who cannot afford legitimate mainline insurance. So what we'll do is we will create what is called an uninsured pool, and all of the people in that pool will pay a few dollars and they can receive basic insurance. That was in September. In November, Governor Perry said, well, sorry for your luck, thanks for the premiums, but we're killing that program. And in January, you're going to have to get into the marketplace, which we don't participate in.
I don't know why you're talking about
this. That's going on. This is the craziness that's going on. Part of it is that we're finding that we have been frauded for a long time. This is why insurance costs have been going up so much. At the same time, people who cannot afford insurance have only one outlet to receive needed medical care, and that's the emergency room, which creates what's called uncompensated care, which eats into the ability of hospitals to provide care. And instead of having a $20,000 bill that's never going to be paid, if you have basic insurance with hospitalization, like, for instance, with Medicare or Medicaid, those bills are paid for. They're not paid for at rack rate, but there is a significant payment made on that care, and the insured participates in the payment because they have, you know, they have, like you do with your insurance, they have level thresholds that they have to meet in participation in their insurance, but it doesn't cost them $1,700 a month. It costs them $100 a month, same insurance. Okay, if you can do that and you can insure an additional 80 million Americans who are paying for their insurance, you're not funding anything. You're paying for that insurance. There's another 27 million Americans who will receive assistance in paying for that insurance through the marketplace that is largely funded, by the way, by insurers who pay to get into the market. They'll say, if we have to cover this class of people at this rate, we understand that they can't afford to pay $1,000 a month in insurance, so we'll split the difference with the government, and everybody pays a third. The government pays a third, the insurer pays a third, the insured pays a third. And that's the way that's working. So I'm seeing this as a positive. Yes, it's a negative in some aspects for the health insurance companies, but you've got to understand that the health insurance companies in America are the only industry in America that make more profit per quarter than oil companies.
That's not true.
And they're doing it on the, oh, yes, it is. It's absolutely true. And
how much profit do they make?
The insurance company as a whole, insurers are making on average $8 billion a quarter. Oil companies are making on average $6.7 billion a quarter in gross profit. The reason this happens is because
because it's the most, the insurance market is the most regulated market in the country. State and politicians control it completely. You can't buy across state lines, so you're stuck in the state.
You can't buy across state lines. You have 50 state commissioners of insurance who are responsible for the regulation of the sales of insurance within their states.
Right, so you can't buy across state lines, but politicians forbid you to buy across state lines.
Well, that's something that's been agreed to for a very, very long time. And by the way, it was at
the
request of insurers that that was true. The insurers were trying to carve out their own markets within, like, major metropolitan areas versus rural areas. And
Pardon? You know, it's just like in when mobsters take over cities, you know, they don't want any other mob in the town in order so that they don't have to start competing about selling illegal booze for lower price because there's another supplier offering it for less. So they separated it by state. The politicians do this. No business can do this.
There's an old rule of business that says you're the number one guy in town until the second guy opens shop.
Right, but the second guy can't open.
You know, there's anybody can go into a state and presume to sell insurance.
No, they can't.
Sure, they can.
You have to be approved by the health administration. Every plan has to be approved by them.
Every form has to be approved. I know this.
So how are they substandard if government already regulates every single plan an insurance company can offer? And they don't allow you to buy across state lines. They appoint one, two, or three in each state that you're the only ones you're allowed to buy from. And
you're talking about the marketplace?
No, I'm talking about before the marketplace and the marketplace.
Okay,
and
the marketplace's idea is that it offers anyone who is qualified to sell insurance today in a state the opportunity to participate in the marketplace in that state. The only requirement is...
two choices there.
No. I think there's only one part of one state where you only have two choices. I know where I live in Tennessee, there are 9 companies that offer 52 different plans. Okay? And of those plans, in order to participate in the marketplace, if you're Jay's Insurance, regardless of the number of plans or forms, if you will, if you want to use insurancees, that you sell in that state, one of them must include a bronze, silver, and gold plan. You can have a platinum plan or a Cadillac plan or anything else. You can have other policies that don't have those plans, but at least one policy form you have must be within the marketplace guidelines, silver, gold. Okay.
Right, but in many states, it's one or two companies, and that's it. And you can have 3 plans, but it's only one or two companies, the same ones that are the only ones allowed to sell to begin with in those states. Now, some conservative states allow more insurance companies. Massachusetts only has one. California has 3 or 4, you know, and because they control politically appointed insurance companies. They can't operate without it.
Insurance commissions, some are politically appointed. That's true. And the thing is that what we're seeing as the marketplace develops in those states where there are only 2 or 3 plans, it is the potential insureds that are saying, we want more options. That's why there was trouble in Florida. That's why there was trouble with Aetna. That's why there was trouble with Blue Cross, because Blue Cross was still trying to maintain a monopoly in the states they were, and they were not going to offer a silver, bronze, or gold plan. And the government said, I'm sorry, that ain't going to be the case. You're allowed to sell insurance, but you are not allowed to sell insurance that at least one form does not qualify for participation in the marketplace. Now, one could rightly ask the question, why would you purposely eliminate the possibility of hundreds of thousands of policyholders in a state? Well, it was too expensive to operate in that state in the first place. They chose to work in only the highest-end markets. They chose, and of course, you know, we're talking about 5% of the insurance industry here, right?
Because the employer mandate was delayed for a year, so everyone with employer health care doesn't have to comply yet. So that's why it's only the private insurance market right now. You know.
Well, what are employers doing?
Can I just say something? Let me just tell you. In a market where the politicians don't let citizens to buy outside the state, and then when they force them to buy only from in-state, and they only 1, 2, or 3 in the state, in most states, that you're allowed to buy from. And then the politicians also set up what's called the Medicare reimbursement schedule, which is the price that must be paid for every single healthcare procedure and tool. And when you have a market like this controlled by politicians, they control the consumer, they control the supplier, and they control the pricing and the checks that go out. And all the insurance companies allowed in each state must follow the Medicare reimbursement schedule and pay a little more, up normally 20% more. And then the reimbursement schedule does this. Everyone that's not politically tied, doctors or anyone that's not connected, any segment of the healthcare that's not politically controlled much, gets the minimum reimbursement possible These prices are set arbitrarily. There's no market forces. And everything that the hospitals do and everything that politically controlled segments of healthcare do, like rehab centers, dialysis centers, surgery centers, hospitals, mm-hmm. diagnostic mm-hmm. centers, all get extremely obscene reimbursement schedules and fees back.
Well, you got to know how to do Medicare math. I do give you that.
The difference is
one of technicality. And I think that the first question you ask in all of those instances that you just gave, okay, the dialysis centers, the treatment centers, the urgent treatment centers, the ER, the outpatients, the surgeons, the ophthalmologists, all of those people would tell you, I believe, with a minority exception perhaps, that they would rather receive a percentage of something than 100% of nothing. And when that is the option, then participating in the marketplace, gaining more, and prices are not set by the administration or politicians. Prices are set by the insurers. Plans are created by the insurers. Coverages are instituted by the insurers. The insurers then go to the providers, the medicine, the hospitals, the pharmacy, and they say, will you accept our plan under these conditions when we make these payments? And all of a sudden, you've got hospital systems competing with other hospital systems for multiple insurance companies to be, quote, their insurance. Now, in Tennessee, it is. In the last 3 years, the primary insurers of the hospital insured coverage, okay, the insurance my hospital takes in the last 3 years has changed 3 times. And that is because they have renegotiated the contract with the insurance company to provide coverage for their hospital. And that's absolutely true. And I've got more people in this house than I've got myself that can get on this line and tell you that's the truth. Because we went from one insurance company to another insurance company to another insurance company within 3 years. That all had to do with pricing. It all had to do with market. And it all had to do with sales. At the same time, those companies who lost those contract bids lost the ability to provide their insureds with the coverage they needed because, and this is only as an example, say Blue Cross Blue Shield or Anthem of Tennessee lost a contract at my hospital who no longer recognizes or accepts their insurance. Maybe it's because of the Medicare math. Maybe it's because of the low payments. Maybe it's because of who knows. But say Aetna comes in and does a better bid, covers more services, pays a better outpay, and all of a sudden the insurance that Aetna provides is recognized as payment by the hospital. And Blue Cross is considered to be out of network, which means, of course, all those things that being out of network means. Vanderbilt Hospital System versus St. Thomas Hospital System. These are all competitive marketplaces for this insurance. The only trouble is the guy that's sick at the ER doesn't care. And
How is it competitive if you're a provider and there's only two or three companies that control 80% of all the insured in the state? How do you go negotiate with them? And you either accept what they pay you or you don't do business.
Well, that's exactly what I just said. There is a competition between those insurers, and it has become such an active market that one of them will win, two of them will lose, and if you're in the two that lose, that hospital will not accept your insurance, period. They only accept, the way a lot of hospitals do it, Jay, is that they come in under employee plans where they offer the employees of the hospital a plan with the understanding that they're going to cut the balance to the employees and make it up on the insureds who come to the hospital under their plans. There are a lot of different market forces in play here, but you're absolutely right. If you have two or three insureds in a state, say, that take 80% of the insurance, They are in competition against each other, and I'll guarantee you they're in competition most at the hospital door. Now, what we want to see, what I want to see as a progressive Democrat, is fewer people who have to become bankrupt because of they're involved in, say, getting T-boned by a drunk teenager. And all of a sudden, they're in a vegetative state, and they've got to be paying these thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dollars that they can't pay. And they go bankrupt, and they lose their homes. You know, when you're talking about it, you and I are talking about it from different perspectives. Okay, I think we can agree to that. You're talking about it from a business corporate perspective. I'm talking about it from an individual patient perspective. But I believe that there's room for both of us in this conversation. I truly do. And I truly believe that between you and I and those of your side and those of my side, having reasoned discussion, we can come up with a solution that works for everyone. It may not be total free market like you want. Every patient may not be covered for every injury or illness like I want. But if we could just dialogue and come together and sit at a table with the common determination that we're going to do the most for the most, I believe we could solve this problem. Would you agree with that or disagree with that? I guess we've lost him. That's what we're trying to do here. What we're trying to do is to create a situation where those who are concerned about, you know, not selling insurance policies across state lines, by the way, as far as I'm concerned, there's a huge benefit in doing that. Keeping it within state lines, because not only does it increase the competition possibilities, but it limits the excess. When insurance companies especially, and I'm not exactly sure why, it's not the only market, but it's certainly the most apparent market, continually raise their rates without increasing coverage or providing better benefit, it hurts everyone. Now, there's a market that says, you know, if you want a $54 a month policy because you're 18 and invincible, well, okay. You can have insurance that costs $54 a month, and you're invincible. But don't expect to get anything for it, because after all, you're invincible. We agree with you. You're invincible. You're not going to get sick. You're not going to get hurt. You're not going to get injured, and you're not going to have an illness. So you have insurance. Congratulations. Go forth and multiply. Jay, I thank you for your call today. I hope you're still listening. I don't know what happened to the phone, but I presume it's a technical error on our part, and if you want to, call back. The question is, who winds up paying for it? Now, when it's an ER, the answer is all of us. When it's the food pantry, I wish it were all of us. But it's not. And one of the arguments that I hear a lot from a lot of folks is, let charities cover it. Charities can't cover it. The amount of money that was lost in the SNAP program in the month of November 2013 is, in a vast majority of the cases, more money than charities have to provide equal assistance in a year. We talked about the LIHEAP program and energy last week. We talked about the rates going up and a 38% decrease in funding available for the LIHEAP program this year, and many, many, many districts have put the entire LIHEAP program on hold. Well, Okay, what happens when there's no food? When you go to the pantry and it's empty, when there's no one bringing their cans of fruit or whatever, what do you do then? And there are situations where people are looking for help today. And there's no help available because their local ministry or their food pantry is empty. It's coming up on Thanksgiving. It's coming up on Christmas. Now, to a lot of people, these are secular holidays that have no meaning at all, but to an awful lot of families and an awful lot of traditions in this country, it means a lot. And I've heard conservatives who say that Christmas is so secularized that nobody understands what Christmas is about. How can you say that on the one hand and then ply your children with every gift that a tree could possibly hold on the other? How could you decry the fact that there's no food in a food pantry and not take a can to or a bag or a loaf of bread to yours? This is not something that is universally attributable to the other side, whatever other side you may see. It is something that we have allowed to happen as citizens of this country. We have come somehow to believe that it really is all about us. It's never been all about us. Never. Corporations are what created this country. The 13 original colonies were originally 13 original corporations. But they understood the absolute necessity of success by those who would come to this country, populate their areas, generate taxes, become communities. And they had a social contract within those communities that for this they would give that. Until such time as that they had to give was no longer needed, and then those corporations went away. And as each corporation went away, states began to organize. And so it was with the 14th and the 15th and the 16th state. Kentucky was carved away from the Commonwealth of Virginia, as was West Virginia. Tennessee was carved away from North Carolina. And the states grew. And as each state grew, companies would come into those states to do things. And one of the things that was most obviously apparent prior to the establishment of the colonies at Plymouth Rock and in other places was that Europe was full. There was no place to expand. If you did not have a business in London, you could not get a business in London, because there was no place for it above and beyond the usual, you know, competitive thing where I've been here since 1307 and I don't need any competition. And then the advertising would start or the wars would start, and there were wars. And then there were unions, and then there were religious groups, and then communities started taking on their own definitions. And they started understanding a need to protect themselves from invaders or outsiders. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of people will tell you that most of America was stolen from people who were here already. And as the Europeans came and brought their business and their agriculture and their disease and their plagues, they brought death. That's another story. The question is, are we going to allow that to happen again? Are we going to turn a blind eye as those around us die? It can be that we don't. And it doesn't matter what your political persuasion is. My friend Jay is correct. We've become a very self-serving country. And I don't argue with him much on that at all. The question is, who do we serve? I've always said that I agree with President Obama's theory that a rising tide lifts all boats, not just all yachts. I don't believe that America was made for the few. We went through that once in the late 17 and early 1800s. It led indirectly to the greatest tearing apart of this nation that any civilized nation in the history of the world has ever survived. Because my interests are more important to me than your interests. We are a union of several states. And in order to be a union of those several states, we each identify and agree that all of us have a superior position to any of us. That we are better off as a nation when our states voluntarily supersede their law, the law of the few, and replace it first with the law of the many. We have never been a nation of men, and we're still not a nation of women. We are a nation of law. We say that no one is above the law. No state is above the law either. And when a state sets out to do things which are against federal law, it is the requirement of the federal law to bring those states into line with the laws that support the rest of the Union, because the Union must be preserved, as Abraham Lincoln said, no matter what. Now, is there a guy in Rhode Island that sees somebody hungry on the streets of Nashville that will pay him a meal? Yes. Are there people in Nashville that will see someone in western Chicago standing on a street corner, obviously destitute, and not hand them a meal? I don't think so. Because I think at our core, we are progressive. We want to act to fix things that are wrong. That's what the people do. That's what citizen does. As citizen, we have forgotten, or we have seemingly believed, that we have abrogated our responsibility as citizen to a political party or a machine or someone doing some strange thing, some strange place. That's not true. It's not true now. It wasn't true then. It has never been true. This is government of, by, and for the people. Not for the few, not for the corporate fat cats. Money is not speech, and corporations are not people. And if you want to listen to Coffee Party Radio, you're going to hear a lot of people say that. You're going to hear a lot of people looking for progressive and forward-moving dialogue in a civil nature where you can have passionate disagreement, but you don't have to be disagreeable. And to my caller, Jay, today, who I hope is still listening, thank you for being civil. I know that you're frustrated. You may believe that I don't hear what you're saying. I hear every word you're saying. And most of it I wish I had a chance to talk to you about, because I think we'd agree about it. But I wish we'd talk about it. And if we can do this at the local level, if we can do this at the courthouse or the church house, why can't we do it at the state house? Why have we given over our nature for the continuation of our existence as a state to people who don't care? And if you're concerned about the exclusivity of the few, start looking at your state house, because 37 of them are controlled by entities that don't give one whit about you. Unless, of course, it is to take your tax money, your children, or your potential. That's not who America is. And while we may come at this from different ideologies or different perspectives, there are some things that we really should have in common. And that is that no man, no action, no committee, no group, no party, no ideology, and certainly no corporation should hold itself forth as being exempt from the law. If you don't like a law, change it. Get out there and talk to your neighbors and say, with the passion that Jay has, this is wrong. We need to fix this. I think Jay would be in favor, if I dare to speak for him, in favor of allowing insurance to be sold across state lines. Get out there and fight for it. Start within 12 blocks of where you live. Talk to your neighbors. And say, you know, I believe that we should be allowed to purchase insurance across state lines. I believe that insurance should be portable. I believe that your insurance should not be tied to your current employer. I don't believe your employer should be able to summarily discharge your insurance as a benefit. And, of course, the next question I would have is, if he does that, is he going to increase your pay for the amount of money that he's no longer paying you for your insurance benefit? And then start looking at that hypocrisy, if you will. In the meantime, the money you're not bringing home is not feeding your family. And it's easy for an employer to say, I'm dropping your insurance, and by the way, I'm not going to pay you an additional income based upon the income benefit you lost because I'm dropping your insurance. Because he's not going to come to your house and sit around your table and watch your child miss a meal. And we have to force that issue. We have to get to the point where in order for someone to do such a travesty upon their employees, they have to take it personally. They have to understand the cost, the benefit, and the need. NBC, need, benefit, cost. There is one particular portion or one particular configuration of that formula that works very well. But does need plus cost equal benefit? Does benefit plus cost equal need? How do you put it together? There's a plus and a minus that you can put in two places, okay? And then put need, benefit, and cost. Just plug it in. Need plus benefit minus cost. Need equals benefit minus cost. Benefit equals need minus cost. Cost equals need minus benefit. Or plus. However you want to see it. And the difference in the result is your ideological position on a situation. Okay? I'm hungry. I have no food. I have money. Is the benefit minus the cost equal to need? Do I want some food or do I want, you know, the most expensive food that money can buy? Am I willing to give up a meal for a fellow citizen who has nothing? If so, when? What are you going to do about it? Thank you for listening to this edition of Progressive Politics Tennessee Style. It'll be replayed again on Tuesday night beginning at 9 p.m. Pacific time over at the NetRoots Radio Network. And as the other networks come online, we'll let you know when you can listen to it there too. We'll be in the chat room during the replay. We thank our visitors today and both our live callers and our chat room visitors for being with us today. And I thank you very, very much for helping us out today. Your call mattered, Jay, and I want you to know that you're welcome here anytime. Thank you to our visitors in the chat room. And we'll see you next week, same time, same channel, for Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, for Progressive Patty and the whole Progressive Politics team. Thank you. Bye-bye for now.